The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 249 Premium for Friday, March 12th, 2010.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Dave Hamilton here in Durham, New Hampshire. All the way from Fairfield, Connecticut, is
John F. Braun, and also
back for a special appearance.
Yes, after 4.5 years of training, I'm back. Okay, it only seems like 4.5 years.
Pilot Pete, ladies and gentlemen.
Hi, everybody.
We got to turn Pete's mic up here.
Oh,
that's all right.
How about Pete, I speak into it? That'll work.
Yeah, Pete gets anywhere near his mic, it'll be all right. Okay, so John, we have a lot of cool stuff. A lot of good questions to go through today. And you actually found on your own a cool thing that we'll mention at the end about Quick Look. And of course today, hour and a half ago, at least at the time of this recording, the iPad became available for pre-order. So how many did you order, John?
I think that'd be none.
Oh, well, what a party pooper you are. I ordered one.
I'm ordering mine as we speak.
I'm letting you people debug the thing for me.
No, John, that's our job. Well, we'll give you a pass on this one because, you know, of course, you did just upgrade to mail.
I can't no handle mercy. Too much change in my life.
I know.
Once, but, pretty much everybody, you know, we had a Mac roundtable earlier this week and, I think almost everybody on the call was fretting over, you know, getting their order in immediately and stuff. And
yeah.
I wonder if we're going to see a bump in the stock because it seems, you know, a lot of people are jumping on the bandwagon. So we'll see how the stock does.
Yeah, that'll be interesting, right? I mean, the stock has already seen a bump from it once they announced the pre-orders, but
it's up already 75 cents today. It's at 227. 50.
Okay. Yeah. So it's up. I think, you know, it's interesting because the sales won't be counted until the next quarter, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Because the iPad doesn't ship until April, or it doesn't get delivered until the 3rd of April, which means it'll ship, you know, probably the 1st. So Pete's asking me in our Skype chat here, which is a good discussion to have. Should I get the 64 or the 32? Or, you know, of course, there is the option of the 16.
16.
So 16 for $4.99, 32 for $5.99, or 64 for $6.99. I think that's right for the Wi-Fi models. I went ahead and did the 32. My guess is, I'll say I did the 32 for this round because I know that in at least 12 months, maybe even six, there'll be another model out that that I'll want to get. And because I have the MiFi, I'm not all that concerned about the 3G version.
Right.
So yeah, I went ahead and did the. I did the 32, right. And I
well,
did
that's
order
coming out later.
What are the chances the memory will be scalable, though? I mean, we've
not
able, none.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, just take a look at your iPhone and how easy it is to upgrade the memory in that.
Well, let me do that.
Yeah. and then you'll have a good idea of how it's going to be there in the iPad. So, all right. Should we get into the questions here, John? Do we have anything anything else to add to our?
I think we should. Well, you got so you did get, but because I did see. So if you want to get, so you can get the one without the 3G immediately, and I think mm-hmm. the one with the 3G is
a couple of weeks later.
Stated, you know, later.
Yeah, they're saying late April is what they're saying. Yeah, for that one. So yeah,
because a lot of people like you, I think, are going for the MiFi one or doing the you know external version, and they're foregoing the 3G.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, yeah, it'll be interesting. I don't know if I'll miss that or not. I guess I'll let you all know, but I am looking forward to it. I believe we're doing a trip to Washington, D.C. for, the kids' April vacation. And I think we're actually going to take the train down. We looked into flights and the flights are, there's no flights at good times. They all stink. And the very few that would be at semi-workable times are, you know, it's going to cost me, I don't know, like $600 a ticket. Whereas the train, I think, will be down closer to about 300. So I think we're going to do the train. So it'll be interesting to have the iPad on the train and see how the family fights over that. So I'm looking forward to that. All right. Should we move on to Connor here? Or start with Connor, I should say, John?
Indeed.
All right.
Hey, guys. This is Connor B. Since you were able to answer my my last two technical questions. I just have a more theoretical question that doesn't actually make a difference to me right now, but I was just curious. You had a caller on your last podcast, I think it was Robert Hazelrig, who got a refurb Mac. I have always known that buying a refurb Mac is a fantastic deal.
It is.
But one thing I'm not entirely sure about is whether or not when you get one that was released before, like say if you got a Mac now that was discontinued before Snow Leopard came out, do you get the version of the operating system that would have come on that Mac originally, or do you get the latest version of the operating system that is available and runs on that Mac?
All right. And since I can't seem to EQ the quality of that call any better, we're just going to cut you off there, Connor. But I think we got the question through. So this is interesting. John, you did some research, and why don't you tell us what you found?
And I think we have what they say. And if you go and you dig into the Apple Certified Refurbished Products page, I found a page here and it explicitly says right here, includes the operating software, I assume they mean operating system software, originally shipped with the unit and the custom software offered with that system. But it also says, see each product's learn more for more details. So it seems their official position, at least in this document, is at the very least, you will get the discs that the machine shipped with. But then, Dave, you have some actual hands-on experience with this, I believe.
Yeah, well, yeah, and Pete's reporting similar experience to me. Pete, why don't you tell him what you just, right, because you just ordered a refurb.
I did. My refurb, I got, let's see, I think it was last August. And, no, it was September. And it came with Snow Leopard on it. But the machine was built pre-Snow Leopard.
Okay. Okay, and that's been my experience too. And as soon as this question came up, I didn't even bother researching. I just kind of put in the notes or in our agenda. Yeah, I believe it does. I believe there's no worry about that at all. And then John, of course, you found the Apple's policy. However, I do believe I remember, and we could look on the Apple Store to confirm this, but I believe I remember seeing that the machine is listed with an operating system when you go into the details, just like a new machine would be. And I've never seen it include anything other than the most recent OS, or at least the most recent OS that would run on that machine.
Incidentally, I had a question on mine. I was all set to order it online and pulled the trigger, and I had a question, and I don't remember specifically what it was, but I picked up the phone and I called Apple and I said, you know, I'm looking at this one in the refurb store, and here's my question. They answered it. I said, okay, I want the machine. And she goes, I'll be happy to place the order and finish it for you right here. So they'll be more than willing to help you live voice as well as just ordering it online.
Cool. Cool. Were they able to pull up the order that you had in process?
They were, actually.
That's great. Oh, yeah. Wow. That's huge. So you could go through and spec it all out. And then if you've got one specific question, you can call and you're not back to square one.
Exactly.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Exactly.
It was wow. Nice. Huh. Very cool. Awesome. Good discussion. I like that. All right. On to David, John. Or do we have more for this?
I seem to recall that they would offer some sort of reduced price OS upgrade if you did purchase something that was on the edge. And I think it would apply to refurbs as well. But as you guys are saying, it sounds like they just, rather than stick you with the older OS, it sounds like when they do the refurb, they put the latest one on there for you.
I think what you're referring to, John, or what you're remembering is, when you buy a machine after Snow Leopard was introduced, but before it shipped, you get a coupon for some reduced price upgrade. And I believe those coupons also worked with refurbs purchased during that period of time.
Yeah. It was usually like $10 or something minimal. I think it just covered the cost of the media and the shipping.
Yeah, right.
That, so,
right.
Okay,
cool.
That's all I got.
All right. On to David.
Hi, Dave and John. David from London in the United Kingdom here. A couple of questions for you. Regarding the wireless mouse, the low battery warning kicks in at about 25%. I'm using the lithium batteries that run the mouse for weeks and weeks, so 25% is really far too soon. Is there any way of changing the threshold to say about 5%? And in Safari, the default search engine is google.com. Now, I'm in the UK, so I'd prefer it if the search was google.com. safari.co.uk. I looked all through the preferences in Safari, but I can't find any way to change this. Now, this is where you cut me off.
All right. And I thought the audio errors were his, but they are ours. One moment, please. All right. So those despite the fact that I pulled an extra FireWire audio interface off the chain, we are still dealing with the fact that FireWire audio on the Mac, despite the fact that it should be more reliable, it simply is not, and will likely go ahead and get a USB audio interface to use for the show. As ridiculous as that sounds on paper, that appears to be the solution. So, as for a solution for David's issue, John, I think for number one, for the wireless mouse battery warning, you've got an idea on this one.
Not only an idea, but a solution. And the solution is our pal Better Touch Tool. We will link to this tool.
Really?
But if you look in Better Touch Tool, in their preferences, mouse, general, there is a selection, warn if battery level is below, and the default, as was pointed out by David, is 25%. It looks to me you can change that to whatever you want, which for him is a good idea because, yeah, those batteries, depending on the type of battery, because if you get rechargeables, those also, you know, the voltage is lower and stuff like that. He has, you know, beefier batteries. So anyways, that's it. We'll link to the utility. It does a whole bunch of things, but this is one of the little hidden features that I wasn't aware of until I searched for it. So
cool. All right. Well, I can take the other one for Safari searches. You can change the default engine. And for that, I use Glimpse, which is available at machangout.com. It's a great little Safari add-on. And I've used it for a long time. Apple's actually put some of Glim's features into Safari, like the search look ahead and that sort of thing. But Glim's is still quite valuable. And you can check it out at machangout.com. So moving on to Michael, John, you got anything to add here? All right. Let me find Michael here. Why can't I find Michael? Oh, you know, here we go. All right. Michael writes, "Hi guys, I'm about to get a new 27-inch iMac soon. I currently have a 20-inch iMac that I will give to the kids. I'm thinking of using Migration Assistant to move my home folder and my wife's home folder to the new machine. I'm not going to move applications over, but instead reinstall from the web or CD. Also, some applications that are on the 20-inch, I will not put on the new 27. So the question, when I migrate mine and the wife's stuff over, will the supporting files of applications that I will not put on the new iMac also port over? What would you guys do in my case?" All right. You want to take this one, John, or should I run with it?
I'll start off here. So I found some screenshots of the steps that you take in the Migration Assistant, and then you can follow up on this.
Okay.
And I think the key is it depends on what you choose. So one of the first screens that you see when you run the Migration Assistant, step one, actually, in the shot I have here, it says, pick users to transfer to this machine.
Okay.
And it'll show all the users on the machine, and you can migrate any of them or none of them. So that's one choice you can make, but then a subsequent screen, the one that comes up after that, then has a number of choices, one being migrate applications and another being migrate files and folders. So if I'm reading that correctly, depending on which of these items you pick, he can do what he wants.
Sort of. If he picks his user folder to migrate over, my experience has been that migrates the entire user folder over, even if you don't choose to migrate applications, right? It migrates the entire folder, which includes the library and the application support and all of that. So I think he is going to get the entire thing, and including all those settings. So yeah, there will be some cruft out there and potentially some things that will be inherited by apps that he then installs going forward on the machine. One thought I had as we were going through this, though, John, is perhaps the best way to do it, and this sounds a little funky, but perhaps, well, there's two ways to do it. One is just copy the documents folder over, right? Don't use Migration Assistant. Just, you know, get the new Mac up and running, create the users, and, you know, share the drive over the network and copy the files, right? That's one way. The other way would be to migrate everything and then install Hazel. And then as you delete each app that you don't want to use or that you want to reinstall, Hazel's going to pick that up and say, hey, you're throwing away this app. Do you want me to go and throw away all of the supporting files for it? And then it's cleaning it out. You know, Hazel's not going to be perfect. It's not written by Apple, nor is it written by every application vendor that's out there. So it's up to them to manage that database. But it could be a good solution. But I think just copying the documents folders over would be better. You're not going to get your preferences that way, but maybe you don't want that. Maybe you do. So you got, am I swimming up the wrong stream on this one, John?
No, I'm with you. Yeah. So if he did choose, yes, I pointed, if he chose the users, then I agree with you. It would bring over all the cruft, including preferences and library and stuff like that. So probably the best path would be not to choose the users to transfer and just, assuming he exercises, good document storage practices and stores all his documents in documents.
Yes. Yes, I did make that assumption. How could you not these days, though? I don't say that to be demeaning, but maybe I do. I don't know. I mean, seriously, it's so easy to just store your stuff in the documents folder that there's really no reason not to. I mean, maybe you've got stuff stored in the home/Dropbox folder if you're a Dropbox user, but I'll be honest, I don't use that folder. I actually map my Dropbox to a folder inside my documents folder so that I've got all my documents up on the Dropbox, but they're still in the right place. Otherwise, what else would you have? Go ahead.
I've seen one thing. Some people on both Macs and Windows like to put everything on the desktop. So maybe an additional suggestion is, in addition to the documents folder.
Yeah, that's true.
If that's the way that, you know, anyone in the household or any of the users store their stuff, there's of course an explicit desktop folder in your user directory.
That's true. Actually, I'll open that up and say that I would copy documents, music, movies, pictures, desktop, and Dropbox if it's there. Yeah.
But not library.
But not library.
Applications.
Yeah. That's right. And really where I was going with my rant there was against the people that in the past have had the habit of simply storing their documents on the root of the hard drive. That's just back in the OS 9 days, you know, when permissions were not yet part of our Mac world here in that sense, I saw tons of people that would just store all their, they just save them to the hard drive. Well, that's what you were told to do, right? I'm just going to save my documents to the hard drive. It's like, oh man. But when it was time to migrate to a new computer, it was like, oh boy, there's going to be a lot of hours billed today finding all your stuff, you know, much better if you keep it in one place. So, and they thought they were keeping it in one place. And to be fair, they were. It was just one big, messy place. So. All right. Off to Kenneth, John? Is that where we're going with this? Okay. Kenneth writes, after applying the 10.5.8 update, and that's where we're going with this, right? Yeah. After applying the 10.5.8 update, some subset of my startup items were lost. I re-entered them into my account's login items tab in System Preferences. And on subsequent restarts, again, the ones that were added were lost. I trashed the preference file, or at least my best guess as to what I thought the preference file was, which was com.apple.loginitems.plist, and restarted. But the problem continues. This applies not only to programs that were deposited in the account's startup items list, again, under the account's preference pane of System Preferences, but also to various other preference panes. Some started up again, some didn't, and had to be restarted by going into each preference pane and starting them up. No apparent changes, again, other than the restart I mentioned in number one. But after I had, I think that's where we're stopping here. Okay, so here's the thing on this one. I used one of my new favorite tricks of setting up a spotlight search that shows files modified today inside my library or my library preferences folder. And then I sort them by time modified. And this search is a live search. It will self-update as files are updated. So I set that up first. I had that open in a window. Then I opened up startup items. I opened up system preferences, login accounts, and then went to login items. And I edited the list there. And immediately I saw a file jump to the top of the list, but it wasn't what I thought it was. I would have agreed with Kenneth that com.apple.loginitems.plist would track, as you might imagine, the login items, but I would have been wrong. It's in home library preferences login window.plist. No com, no dot apple that I could find. It was just login window.plist. And that's where all this stuff was stored. So my guess is that there's a permissions issue or perhaps some file corruption on that file, and either repairing permissions or, as Kenneth did, it looks like I looked at the contents of it, which you can open in plist editor or BB edit or text wrangler. And it seemed like that's all that was in there. So, you know, you could blow that file away and try it again. My guess is that's going to solve it for you. I'm just guessing that the system could not write to that file. So that was my thought on that. I have not heard back from Kenneth, I don't believe, on this one. So any thoughts on this, John?
You know, that's very unusual because I've never seen a situation where things just disappear. So one preference, I'd be very curious.
Well, this wasn't probably random, right? I mean, it was, he would put something in there and then when he rebooted, it was gone.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the only weird behavior I've seen is that sometimes in the login items, you'll see an item come up saying unknown, which indicates that someone's gotten rid of the application, but that's not happening.
Yep.
I want to be careful, though, in the terminology here, because there is something called startup items, which is not this. And I've seen some kind of weird that I looked at my system and I think there's one in library startup items.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. And home library startup items. There's two of those folders. Yeah. Yeah.
And actually, I saw some of those are things that I haven't used for a while. So that looks like some cruft I may want to get rid of. Being very careful. But I just want to be clear with the terminology, because at least the OS X startup item means something different here.
Yeah, I think the startup items folder was, I don't know if it's deprecated or not, to be honest. I don't know if it's still considered to be used by Apple or not. On the machine that I'm on right now, there is nothing in my library startup items on the root of my drive, nor in my home library startup items folder. But I have seen things out there, and it is a good place to look, especially if you've upgraded from various older versions of Mac OS X up through whatever you're on now. So
yeah, I've gotten a couple of current things in there, so it's still being used by some people.
Okay. Okay.
And I don't know if it's LaunchD or somebody links to the stuff in there. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I think the folder that we're talking about, to be clear and or confirm for me, John, if it's the same for you, but it is startup items, capital S, capital I, but no space in between startup and items. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. That's correct.
Okay. So I think anything that you put in there will launch when the system starts up. I think Mac OS X still honors whatever's in there. I just don't see the OS itself putting anything out there. So yeah, very interesting. All right. Along with this, Steven has something similar. I think you're going to play his. There we go.
Hi guys. It's Steven from Ottawa calling. Just have a little problem with the login items on my Mac. This actually has happened on both my iMac and my MacBook. My MacBook. They're both running Snow Leopard. And what happens is after I log in, all or most of my startup items or login items are missing. So I go into System Preferences and they're not there. So I've had to manually add everything back, No, it's sometimes it's nice to clear out some of the cruft or whatever, but it does mean you suddenly lose some functionality if an app that you use installs a little helper application to do various things. So I was just wondering why this would happen, and if there's any way to stop it, and if there's any way to recover from it. I have a Time Machine backup, but I'm not sure which, there's probably a plist file, but I don't know which one governs that. So, you know, I could do a restore on that, I suppose, but not sure how to do that. So any help with that would be appreciated. This is where you cut me off.
Yeah. Okay. So we know what file to look at, right? Home library preferences login window.plist. And from there, you know, the first thing I would do, especially in your case, Stephen, where you're trying to recover what used to be out there, if possible, would be to look at that file. And again, plist editor. And is plist editor only installed part of the developer tools, John? Is that right?
From what I've seen, yeah. Property list editor, those you pointed out, BB edit is, though BB edit shows it to you pretty much in the raw kind of nastiness.
No. No, it doesn't. BB edit will read binary plist files, as will text wrangler, and it will show them to you in a text form, in an XML form. So yeah, it's raw, but it's not binary, right?
Right. You're correct. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But you're right. Property list editor has a UI that's built for this. And where is property list editor? Is it installed with the developer tools? Is that where it lives, John?
Let's see here. It's coming up top hit, and I'm pretty sure it's developer/application/utilities.
Okay. So in order to get property list editor, you have to install the free developer tools. There is also a shareware app, I believe, called plist editor. So there's various ways of looking at these. Once you get the file open, take a look and see. And in your case, Stephen, the active file might very well be empty, but it might also be somewhat corrupted. And at least you can see what was out there. When you're looking at this, you'll see the name of the file, and it's going to be in sort of a hierarchical format. But you'll see the name of the file, and then you'll also see the path to it. So it might be, you know, /yourappname.app/content/macOS/, you know, startup item. So either write that down or take a screenshot using, Command-Shift-3. You'll take a screenshot of the whole screen, or Command-Shift-4 will allow you to draw a little box. It'll give you a crosshair and you draw a box. And as soon as you release that mouse, it will take a screenshot of the area you just defined and save it to your desktop. So take screenshots of that. And then when you're going to go, you know, then I would say, once you figure out what was out there, if you can see it, then delete that file, reboot to have it recreate a new one, and then off you go. So it could also be a permissions problem with that file, right, John? And then that's also the file you'd pull off your Time Machine backup. I'm not sure what else to do. Is there anything that'll repair these, John, that you know of, plist files?
Well, one thing I'm looking at here, Dave, I'm a bit confused because I see the two different files. The one that you mentioned, login item or login window?
Login window, yeah.
.plist. Then I see login items.plist. When I look at my login items.plist, that is the file that explicitly points out all of my startup items.
Really?
Or at least a portion of them. Well, I'm looking right now, and if I open up com.apple.loginitems.plist, one file, which is in my home directory, has 16 items, and then the one that's in the system directory has an additional 4 items. And if I go in property list editor and I click on the little triangle, it will, so it's root, branch list, custom list items. You dig down a bit, and actually I'm seeing names of thing, Mira, RCD, HP product research, all that garbage that HP throws in there. but I hit either one of those files. I mean,
interesting.
It does bother me that things, I mean, things don't, I mean, this is like X-Files, things don't disappear. No. I'm concerned that things in both of these cases seem to go away with the on a whim. And perhaps a thing to do is, now you should be able to, if you do a time machine, you should be able to go to an earlier version. I'm wondering what, if any, items are disappearing, and I'm still kind of at a loss here. As to,
okay, I mean, yeah, this is bizarre. I'm with you, John, because loginitems.plist and loginwindow.plist both have different items. In fact, it seems like loginwindow.plist is a subset of com.apple.loginitems. So perhaps we've got to look at both of these files. The odd thing for me was, and I tested this a couple of times because I thought it was very strange that loginitems.plist wasn't being affected when I was editing my login items tab in system preferences, right? I mean, it would, you know, stand to reason, but it was not. It would, you know, it definitely, in looking at the, you know, the list of found files, the one that was being updated was loginwindow.plist. No com, not Apple. Now there is a com.apple.loginwindow.plist in your home folder in preferences, but that's a different file that actually sets some other options. Yeah, very, very strange. So yeah, I would, if you've got corruption, either repair or delete and restore, or delete and create new versions of both of those files. Man, that's weird.
I wonder if there's a subtle, you know, interaction between the two of them where they get out of sync or something. I don't see any sort of repair option. No, at least not at a quick look here, at least in the Apple property list editor.
So. Yeah, man, this is bizarre. Hmm. A mystery. All right. Well, maybe somebody out there knows. Pete, you have the magic answer?
I got nothing.
But it's great to have you here.
Yeah.
All right.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. All right. Is it time to move on to Bush, John?
Indeed. Okay. I learned something here.
Okay, cool. So Bush writes, after listening to you guys praise SSDs on many a show, I finally broke down and picked one up the other day. All I can say is, wow, it was worth every one of the 60,000 red cents I gave for it. I have since taken the internal spinner that was in the MacBook and put it in an external enclosure, which SuperDuper uses to clone my SSD every morning at 3 a.m. The problem is that every morning at 5 a.m. when I get downstairs, Spotlight is indexing the freshly formatted drive as it has been removed from the exclude list when SuperDuper formats it. Any chance you guys know of a trick or a script to auto-include the newly formatted hard drive from Spotlight? Should I just use the smart update feature instead of erase and copy in SuperDuper? So the first thing, just to give this some context for those of you that aren't aware, if you have a drive or a folder that you don't want Spotlight to index, what you do is you go into System Preferences, you go into Spotlight, you go to Privacy, and you either drag the folder or drive in there or hit the little plus button, navigate to it and choose it. And then that will tell Spotlight, do not index this volume, right? The important thing, I think, to remember here, though, is what happens when you do that. It runs a command called mdutil, which is a terminal command, and it goes and tells the volume, don't be indexed with Spotlight. So this is a setting that's saved on the volume. Do you have anything to add here, John, as we're kind of rambling through this?
That's the thing I learned from you, because I have done this with Carbon Copy Cloner. Apparently, I just use the correct method. One thing is, I would give, you know, the backup drive a different name. I wouldn't give it the same name. I'd call it like backup of John's hard drive.
Right.
I never ran into this, so I was questioning this, but until you showed me the light and explained to me why I wasn't running into this problem, in that, yes, so it stores that configuration on the drive, which, if it's reformatted, well, it goes by. I thought it was being stored somewhere else.
Right. Yeah, it's not something, and this is important to know, if you tell a drive, do not be indexed by Spotlight, an external drive, and then plug it into another Mac, it's not going to be indexed there either. There is a file saved, a hidden file saved to the drive by mdutil, which is the Spotlight controller that sets this. So what's happening is, of course, Bush's main drive does have his SSD drive. He does want Spotlight on. And when he clones that SSD drive to another drive, well, it inherits it's a clone, right? Other than the name, which you can keep separate, it basically is the other drive, which includes the magic little file that says, hey, Spotlight, index me. And that's bad. So, and the command, if you want to do it from the command line, it's mdutil space dash I space off, and then the path to the drive, which would be /volume/drive name. And of course, if you want to turn it on, you just change the off to an on. But of course, you can manage all of this from the privacy tab in Spotlight system preferences. But you don't want to manage this every day, Bush, and I don't blame you. And you had your own answer there. I too do exactly the same thing that you're doing here, Bush. I have my main drive, which is an SSD, cloned to a spindle drive every day. And I use SuperDuper, but I do use their smart update feature instead of erasing copy. And one thing that I have seen in SuperDuper's smart update is as it goes through, before it clones the drive, it has a little line item that says saving Spotlight stat, you know, state of drive. And then after the clone, it says restoring Spotlight state or preserving Spotlight state. So it actually goes back and alters this. Now, the difference with SuperDuper anyway, which is a great little app. I you know, it's one of those things I use every day. I don't think about it, and I couldn't live without it. I'd need something else to take its place if I wasn't using it. Erase and copy does exactly what you're talking about, where it formats the drive and then puts a fresh install of or a fresh clone or copy of whatever it is you've told to put on there. It also has a smart update feature, which in the end does everything that an erase and copy does, except it doesn't erase and copy. It looks at what's out there and says, hey, that file's the same as what's over here. I don't need to refresh that. So it only updates the changes. But in the end, you are left with a clone. Of course, in this case, SuperDuper's smart enough to then go through and preserve your Spotlight status. So yes, I highly recommend it. Not only will it be faster, but it will achieve the results that you're looking for. So, and that is better for the drive. You don't want to hammer the drive any more than you need to. So that's my thought on it. Now, you do the same thing with Carbon Copy Cloner, John, is that right? You do a daily backup kind of thing, or?
Not daily. I let a time machine take care of that.
Okay.
But okay. Like a lot of times before I leave for a trip, for example, if I go on a trip where, you know, there's a risk of the machine exploding or something, I'll do a, so I don't do a carbon cut because, you know, it takes a while. So I don't do that as often as, I mean, the time machine thing I run, I actually customize it with the time machine editor.
Yep.
So it's not running every hour, which I think is excessive.
I believe so.
But yeah, I do the same thing, carbon copy cloner. And again, I've never run into this because I guess I select the mode that does not reformat the drive. It just pretty much does the equivalent, I guess, of a smart update.
I think it's doing the same thing. So yeah, and just while we're on the subject, the semi-tangent of backup strategies, I too also use Time Machine. I have it customized on my various machines. I use Time Machine Editor, just like you, to set it not to update every hour, but you know, I think on my main machine it's maybe every 4 hours, and then on the others I might be 8 or 12 because I just don't need that you know immediacy. But the reason I do the clone daily in addition to the Spotlight backup is so that at any moment in time, if my hard drive or in fact my entire Mac goes south, I can take this external drive that I have, plug it into any of the other Macs in my house and be back up and running at exactly the point that I was, you know, no more than 24 hours ago, and usually a whole lot less than that because I'm doing it once a day. So that's the reason. It's so that I can be immediately back up and running in some state where I can live. And because I manage my mail with IMAP and my documents with Dropbox, those are saved out to the cloud immediately. You know, those changes are always reflected as long as I'm online. So as soon as I boot from this other drive, it's updated from Dropbox, it's updated from IMAP, and I'm, you know, there's very little that's not in sync now, you know, maybe some app preferences or something, but I could certainly live without that. So that's where my, there you go. My backup strategy in a nutshell, without having planned it. And anything to add there, John, before we go?
No, I like it. That's a good, yeah, fail-safe. Be more, yeah, you have a backup for your backup.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want the headache of having to restore from a Time Machine volume, right? I mean, that's going to be a several hour affair. If your hard drive dies and you want to restore from Time Machine, it's doable. Apple makes it very easy, but the first thing you got to do is find a new Mac. You got to find a hard drive and you got to boot from the system DVD. You know, if you want to truly restore to exactly what you had before, and then using the system DVD, say I want to restore from a Time Machine backup, and then off you go, and it, you know, clones off to the other drive. But that's going to take hours, depending on the speed of the drive and how much data you had. So I'm not interested in that. I'm impatient. Mm-hmm. Time is money. Mime is money. No Spinal Tap fans here. Somebody out there got it. Speaking of mail, let's dive into something that might get us in trouble here, because I'm not sure I have exactly the answer, but we try to help. So, Jared.
Hey guys, this is Jared in Monterey, California. I was just listening to show number 248 and the conversation you guys were having about Gmail and IMAP. And this is a topic that has been of much frustration for me in using Apple Mail. But that's not why I'm calling. I'm calling to actually ask you guys about the Apple Mail to-do folder that appears on my MobileMe account on the iPhone. For the life of me, I cannot figure out how to get rid of that. I don't use Apple Mail for any to-dos. I've never set up any Apple Mail to-dos. And that folder doesn't show up in mail.app on my MacBook, but it's certainly there in the MobileMe account. It doesn't appear in the MobileMe web interface, and I would sure love to get rid of it off my iPhone. If you guys have any clue at all, please let me know. Here's where you cut me off.
All right. Thanks, Jared. And I know your name is one letter off from Jarrett Reddick of Bowling for Soup. But man, when I hear your voice, I think exactly of him. You sound exactly like him when he talks. Just as an aside, I don't know where I'm going with that, John. So there is this folder out there, and it will be created on Mobile Me Mail, and it'll be created on other IMAP mail if Apple Mail feels it has reason to do so. It does it all on its own and without any prompting from the user. I have been able to avoid this, and I believe that the settings that contributed to that are one or both of the following. In composing, so you go into Mail Preferences, and in composing, you choose the Create Notes and To-Dos in, and I put on my Mac. If you have it set to one or one of your IMAP accounts, then you've got a better chance of it creating that Apple Mail to-do folder out there. The other thing that I have done, and I think this is related, but hey, what do I know, is in accounts, if you go to account details, there's a you pick the account you want, and you go to the second tab, and there you've got all the mailboxes and what you can do with them. Drafts, you know, store drafts on the server, store sent messages on the server, store trash on the server. And another option that says store notes on the server. I uncheck that, and as good measure, I uncheck drafts, because mail doesn't manage drafts on the server well at all, and it'll duplicate them, as I've mentioned many times. So, but I believe that the first one of those, disabling notes from the server, also has helped in this regard. As far as deleting it, that gets a little tricky. I think once you've unchecked that box, once you've set create notes and to-dos on my Mac, and then unchecked that notes box, I think the Apple Mail to-do folder will show up in Apple Mail under your list of folders, and then you can delete from there. You'll see it on the iPhone, but you can't delete or create, I don't think, folders from the iPhone mail interface. If that doesn't do it, if mail.app still masks it, then you're going to need another IMAP client to go in and do this. And I think you can do it with Thunderbird. So launch Thunderbird, connect to your IMAP server, and then you should see the Apple Mail to-do folder, and you should be able to delete it from there, and hopefully it won't come back. So any thoughts on that, John?
Interesting. Now, actually, I had a bunch of to-dos show up. So when I migrated over to Apple Mail, and where I do see them, and I do see the opportunity to create some, though I'm with you that I think the interface is a bit lopsided depending on what device you're using. So I actually used to use a Palm, and I used to use that for tasks.
Yes.
And when I and I still had remnants of my Palm on one of my machines, because when I looked under to-do, there was like years worth of to-dos, which the Palm, you know, as you recall, had a to-do facility, and you would list the task, the end date, you would check it off when you're done. And apparently all of that cruft got brought over. And actually now if I look in Mail, not under mailboxes, but under reminders,
right,
there's two categories. One is notes and the other is to-dos. There's nothing there right now, I think. And I see actually there's an opportunity if you highlight in your mailboxes an IMAP account in the file menu, all of a sudden it appears new to do.
Right.
I don't have any right now. And actually, yeah, as I mentioned, I got rid of all of them because that they were old and I really don't use that facility anymore.
So here's something interesting. The to-dos in Mail, all it's doing is looking at the calendar store on your computer, which is also where iCal stores its to-dos. So you're seeing, when you look at that big long list of to-dos or completed to-dos that Mail shows you, it's a terrible interface, I agree. But what it's showing you is a history of all your to-dos that are stored in iCal. By deleting them from Mail, you have effectively deleted them from iCal as well. So just be aware that's where they were. I think Palm, or whatever you were using to sync with Palm, it finally made its way to saving them in iCal. And then, of course, you saw them when you started using Apple Mail.
It was actually iSync at one
point.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Palm
plugin, and it decided to toss them in there. And the other thing I noticed when I migrated over to Mail,
yep,
is that by default, and I think you suggested unchecking this, I saw my notes, which I maintain on my iPod Touch for the most part, little, you know, reminders and stuff.
Yeah.
Saw it in my inbox, which I didn't like that at all. I'm like, why is this appearing in my inbox? That's not Mail. It's a separate category. Maybe some people like that. I didn't really like it, them putting it in my inbox.
You know, I say this because I firmly believe that all of these product decisions or changes are dictated by how Steve Jobs uses his computer. Right. And as we've seen, no changes will happen to Apple products that Steve uses without him blessing that change. So, you know, if I had a moment to sit down with Jobs, what I'd want to do, and this is just, you know, if I had my moment, I wouldn't want to ask him questions. I wouldn't want to interview him about, you know, the strategy and all that. Plenty of people have done that. What I would want to do is sit down with him in front of his main Mac and say, go. Show me how you organize your day. How do you use Mail, and what do you use it for, and how do you integrate notes or to-dos in there? Because I think that interface sucks, and I can't believe he doesn't think that, right? And also, let's fire up iCal for a moment, shall we? And show me how you manage your life in this piece of crap that you guys call a calendar software. Because I really would like to see how he uses it, right? Because I have to believe that you can't, I mean, anybody with a busy schedule, maybe his schedule's not that busy. Maybe he's a master delegator and he has nothing on his schedule all day other than maybe one or two things. And he has no to-dos because he's delegated all that out. And so maybe he doesn't use that functionality and therefore it sucks and is just kind of gone by his radar. But knowing the control freak that he is, I can't believe he uses that functionality and has let it go on that long. So anyway, that's my little rant.
Okay. Well, I look forward to that meeting that you're going to have with him.
Maybe I'll email him and see if he wants to sit down next time I'm out in San Francisco, and we'll spend 20 minutes going through.
I think he is.
Maybe he should come here.
Mm.
Yeah.
You know, you're a busy man.
I am a busy man. I got stuff to do. And apparently he's not, if he's able to manage his schedule with iCal. Yeah, that's how the email will go. Since it's clear you're not busy based on the fact that you're managing your schedule with iCal and it is incompetent at managing anything more than just one or two events per day, I'd like to request that you fly out here next Tuesday. And actually, next Tuesday won't work for me because I'm in Austin. So
he's going to put that in iCal and get right on it, I'm certain.
That's right. Well, you know, he can use the little data detectors thing, and I'll put it right there. I'll put a time and a date, and he can do that. I'll send him that note. We'll see what he says. He does reply to his email. He reads all his own email. On the, you know, on the occasion or two per year that I have to email him, it's, I get a quick response.
And that email address is?
No, it's not Steve. It's very public. I'm not going to say it here, but it's there's plenty of places you could find it on the web. I'll say it. It's fine. It's sjobs@apple.com. And that gets straight to him. And there you go. You know, but he is, he will reply to his email or forward it off or deal with it immediately. Usually the response comes within about 10 or 15 minutes. So, I recommend you not pester him, but that's between you and him. I don't really care. Okay. Moving along, I recommend you don't pester anybody. You know, probably put me at the top of that list. You know, send me the stuff that you want to send me, but don't pester me. And, John too, Pete, all of us, right? You know. We're not going to pester you. You're not going to pester us. Where's this going, John? Is it time to go to? Oh, hey, you've got something cool. Speaking of frustrations with Apple's implementation of their own technology, you have a solution. Can I describe the problem, John? Because I've lived with this before, and correct me if I'm wrong. Can I describe the problem?
So I never had the problem, but it came up on Twitter last night, and actually, it's not something that ever. I don't really use this feature of OS X that often, but it seems you do. So
we'll stop being mysterious here. Okay. In, I believe, Leopard and later, Apple has implemented this quick look technology, which lets you go to in the Finder or in Mail or in various other pieces of software that support this. You highlight a document and you hit the space bar, and then it shows you in the Finder without launching it. So let's say you highlight a Pages document and you hit the space bar. Boom, it shows you the contents of that. It shows you the contents of a PDF. It'll show you a picture. If it's an audio file, it'll start playing it. If it's a movie, it'll start playing it. And it happens right there in the Finder. Very, very handy. The frustration that comes, and I love it, and this is part of why it gets frustrating here, is that if I, let's say I open a PDF and I've got it up in Quick Look, and now I open up my mail, right? I open up a PDF in the Finder. I click on my mail window, and now I want to, you know, type something that references this. So I want to see them both at the same time. As soon as you switch apps, boom, Quick Look goes away. But when you come back to the Finder, boom, comes back up. It's like, you know, I want that. Just show me that, right? And so, you know, I either have to open the file or take a screenshot of the Quick Look, and it's like, hey, but guys, just show it to me. So, John, you may have the magic answer.
I do have the magic answer. So first I misunderstood the problem, because someone said, well, it disappears when I switch apps. I thought he meant like it closes the window and it never comes back again. So I, you know, did a Quick Look in Finder, did one in Mail. And when I switch between the apps, it would show me the Quick Look when I was in that app.
Correct.
No, what the person wanted to do was, I believe they were entering spreadsheet information in numbers, and they wanted a Quick Look from another application. And so I verified that, this is kind of, you know, it doesn't work the way some people want it to work. And then I started geeking out, and I'm like, there has to be a way. There has to be some way, you know. So I was looking at plist files and all this stuff here, but then I eventually found it. So this is a piece of software. It's actually PrefPane that had the answer. I know it's doing something underneath the covers. I don't know exactly what, but it's called Secrets. And if you go to code.google.com/P-as-in-Peter/BlackTree-Secrets, and this is a PrefPane, they have a category. This is excellent software, though be warned. I mean, this is messing at the very lowest level with stuff in the OS that you may not, but I didn't find any downside here, but I found an option. Finder, Quick Look, and then there was a hide Quick Look on deactivation or application switch checkbox, and it was checked.
Of course.
So this is the default behavior. I unchecked it, and then it worked as this individual wanted it to. So I did a little geek dance, and I'm like, oh, wow, I actually, you know. Hats off to the Secrets folks, because they're the ones. I think they're kind of a community thing, is that people will submit it, because it wasn't there initially, but when I clicked on an update button, I guess it downloads from their database the latest Secrets. So this is one that I think is fairly recent. I don't know if it's in the latest version of, if it was, you know, 10, the latest version of the OS or what. But anyways, there is a way to influence this behavior by using Secrets.
Oh, interesting. I wonder what the terminal command is for that. You know, there's a terminal command for this, right? You know, one of those defaults, comma, yes. You know, whatever. And I looked quick here and I can't find it, but there's gotta be one. And that's awesome. So I'm going to, because I get scared of that secrets thing. And I know it doesn't, by installing it and doing nothing else, it doesn't do anything on its own. Right. So I could install it and just do that. And I probably will, but I would love to find the terminal command, for that, because then I could just do that terminal command and be, totally safe and undo it. If there's some issue, even if I don't have secrets installed. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to use that, John, as a perfect, brilliant segue into the next thing that the last thing, I guess this show's getting long in the tooth here, that we want to talk about here. And it has to do with terminal commands. Chuck writes, I've been listening to your podcast for about 2 years now. My dilemma. I use mail tags extensively in my daily workflow, and as you know, Snow Leopard and mail tags don't always get along so well. Mail tags' default setting for project filtering is case-sensitive, drives me nuts. An InDev, which is the company that makes mail tags, support rep sent me the following email with a solution involving terminal. I'm chicken. Can you guide me or direct me to a resource that would tell me exactly how to do this? And I looked at the solution, and it's exactly what we were talking about previously here. You'll look for something, you know, bear with me here. You'll have some issue. You want to disable Quick Look from going away, or you want to change some behavior of software, and you'll find on the web or someone will point you to and say, you need to write this terminal command. And it'll be something like defaults write ca.indev.mailtags, perform case insensitive comparisons 1. They'll say, oh, just go enter that into the terminal and it'll fix your problem. And if you're comfortable with the terminal, you say, great. And you do that and it fixes your problem, hopefully. But in Chuck's case, he's never used the terminal before. And my guess is that we have lots of listeners here that prefer not to delve in there. But there are some times when you have to, sometimes when there is no secrets pref pane to keep you from having to muck with the terminal. So I wanted to just talk a little bit, John, here about what to do in those cases. We're not, you know, this little segment here isn't built to make you a terminal ninja. It's built to say, okay, look, when you see the instructions, what are you supposed to do? So in Chuck's case, what you do is you open the terminal and then you have one of two things you can do. You get a little terminal prompt and it just sits there and does nothing. You can type out the command by saying defaults, write, et cetera, or you can simply copy it from the web page or email that you're using and paste it in. And then once you paste it, these defaults commands, and this is probably the most common thing that you're going to use in the terminal if you're not a terminal user, is you're going to use these defaults commands to change some setting or some behavior that you want to use. When you press enter, you're just going to get another prompt. There is no fanfare. There is no confirmation of any of this. It's simply, boom, that's it, and you're done. And in Chuck's case, that's all you do. You hit enter, and then you close the terminal window, and then, in theory, launch your mail tags, you know, or mail, and see what the setting is. So John, you've got some other stuff to add to this, and I want to kind of go back and forth with it. But that's the beginning of this, is you simply do that. So,
okay, I don't know if you touched on it. I didn't want to interrupt, but I don't know if you covered how to launch the terminal.
Ah, yes, yeah, you could have interrupted with that. That's always a good question.
Well, again, I want to make sure we have a good flow going on.
How do you launch the terminal?
Thanks, Pete.
Well, I've seen it. Thank you, Pete. Yeah. So, I would go into application. Utilities, or I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's right.
And within there, so there are two ways of doing it. So one, you can go into applications, utilities, and there's terminal. The other way, the handier way, which I typically use, is Spotlight.
Right.
If you do Spotlight, and I use this also to launch the console. I'm not going to go digging around, and I don't want to put a shortcut on my desktop. So anyways, just first thing. So that launches your terminal. And then I think there are a couple of handy little shortcuts that will serve you well when you are messing in the terminal. So one, of course, you can just start typing stuff.
Start typing the things you're supposed to type, not just random stuff. Gotcha. Okay.
Well, you could type random stuff, but typically it's going to yell at you. And don't type random stuff in the terminal. You never know. With the some Unix commands get kind of cryptic with all sorts of characters. So don't just type random stuff.
Right.
But a few features that you may want to make yourself aware of. So one that I found probably the handiest is if you're going to use a command that involves a path to a file. Here's a nice thing. If you start typing a command and then perhaps it involves a path to a file, if you type the first few characters, and you got to make sure you start at the right place. So typically you may want to do a slash, or it depends on if you're in the directory already. If you type the first few characters of the directory or file and then you hit tab, if there's something in that directory that you're currently in that's unique enough to what you typed in the first few characters, then tab will do an autocomplete. I find that really speeds things up for me.
So just for example, if you were going to edit some file in your documents folder and you were when you start terminal, you're in your home folder typically, unless you've changed it. And if you've changed it, then you know what we're going to tell you here. But you're in your home folder. So what you could do is if you're typing something that has to go to your documents folder, you could type D and then O and then hit tab, and it's going to fill out the rest of the word documents with a slash because it's a folder and get you ready for the next thing that you're going to type. So it saves you those characters.
Yeah, it's case sensitive, though.
Yes, thank you.
Like I typed in small d o and it beeped at me when I hit tab because there's nothing. So you got to keep in mind. But if you type in, so I typed in capital D O and then I hit tab and it auto completed the documents. So so that's something to speed you up. Another thing that's not immediately obvious is that, so if you execute a couple of different commands, and I believe if you're in the same terminal session, I think this goes away once you quit, but the up arrow will do the terminal maintains a history of commands that were executed in the past. So if for whatever reason, you either want to do a flashback and see what commands you have executed, or want to repeat one for some reason, if you use the up arrow, it'll go back in time to the ones. Again, I think it's only for the current session, Dave. I think once you quit terminal, that disappears.
It depends. Again, it depends on your settings. You may be right that the default does not save that history. But if you set it to save the history, and again, that goes beyond the focus of this little tidbit here, you can have it save your commands between sessions and all of that stuff. Yeah.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. One last thing. If you do want to retain what you've typed in, because once you close the window, it's all pretty much gone. In the shell menu in terminal is export text as. That will save your entire terminal session to a text file so you can come back and revisit it if you don't quite remember what you did. That could be good for support purposes or just as a postmortem. If you screw everything up, you can look and see what you did to destroy everything.
How you got there. that's right. You know, one other thing that you mentioned in our pre-show, John, that I wanted to make sure we talked about was there are some times when you will see, you know, a command, you'll go to a website or get an email from support that says, go type the following. And the first four characters of what you're going to type are S-U-D-O in lowercase. After you type whatever that big long command is, you're going to be prompted with a prompt asking for your password. And that's your user account password. And the reason is that SUDO command means I want to run this command as the administrator of the computer. And I want full privileges applied to the command that I'm about to type. By entering your password correctly, you have now given that permission. And the command is immediately, upon successfully entering your password, immediately executed with full permissions. So that's what's going on with that. The first time you type sudo, you'll get a little warning that tells you exactly what this is. And then after that, you don't get any warning at all. You just get asked for your password.
Yeah. And I've usually seen that. You usually need to do that is if you try to do something and typically you'll get a message like permission denied.
Yeah.
In which case you may want to be careful because usually things are protected for a reason. So sometimes you may have to do sudo to do something that, you know, people wouldn't normally do.
Right.
Mostly when I see permission denied, that's when I have to remember to type sudo. And then as you pointed out, it caches the, or it won't ask for the password again. It'll the next time you do sudo, it'll just, blast away.
Yeah. There you go. All right. Cool. I think it's time to see if we can invite the band in without them causing us any FireWire-related woes. Seems like we're all right there. As far as contacting us, my guess is because you're all premium subscribers, you know how to do it, but repetition is the key to remembering things, so we'll go through it again. 206-666-GEEK is the number to call, and GEEK is...
4335. And you may also want to email us. And if you want to email us, I'll repeat it once. If you're listening to this, premium@macgeekab.com.
Did you say premium@macgeekab.com?
I absolutely did say premium@macgeekab.com.
Well, that's excellent. That's the right address to use. MacGeekab is our Skype name. I went in yesterday, actually, and made sure that all the permissions on that were correct. And they are. And of course, you can see the excellent show notes that John puts together at MacGeekGab.com. Michael Johnston is the host no longer of the iPhone Alley podcast, the same podcast, new name, This Week in iPhone podcast. He sold his iPhone Alley website. He's transitioning out of that there. So This Week in iPhone podcast is the place to find him. Cashfly Hosting at CACHEFLY.com provides all the bandwidth to get this from us to you. And we do very much appreciate you supporting us and joining us here in our premium option. It's been a whole lot of fun, and I know John and I are having a blast doing the extra shows. It's been fun. We plan on keep doing it for a while. All right, that's it. Right, we're out of here, John. It's time to go. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Let's go home. Wait, I am home. Sort of. I can see my house from here.
Yeah. No, I just got a USPS notification. I think my memory has arrived. So,
dude.
That'll be fun. And whatever you guys do, don't get caught.
Maynard.